The following program, intended for our blind and print-impaired listening audience, is presented by the North Carolina Reading Service. And it's the Indie Week. I'm John Federson, reading this week's issue, which is dated August the 31st of 2023. And, of course, it's presented by your North Carolina Reading Service. And we'll get into our rather specialized issue this week, which is maybe a little different than some of the ones that we've played over the last years. Indie Week, here it comes. And I'm sure that the one news article in the Indie Week has been extensively covered in all other media, and it's the recent shooting on Sunday on the Chapel Hill UNC campus of a PhD assistant professor, presumably, allegedly, by one of his graduate students. And I'm not going to go into any of the details because the investigation is still ongoing, and there are one or two articles about that specifically, and then the student shutdown of the university and the campus-wide anxiety that comes after all such of these incidents. Unknown location, shots fired, no one knows anything for a few hours. And all the details, specificity of motive, and everything else is way down the line of investigation. So I will leave that one behind and read a very short other article from today's IndieWeek.com, and then I will tell you what's coming up for the rest of the hour. And that article says, ex-Wake County Register of Deeds, Laura Riddick is released from prison today. The story originally published at NC Newsline. Former Wake County Register of Deeds has been released after serving 5 years behind bars for embezzling nearly $1 million in public funds. She pleaded guilty in 2018 to 6 felony counts of embezzlement by a public officer. As part of the plea deal, she was sentenced to between 5 and 7 years and ordered to repay over $900,000 in restitution. In a court hearing before pleading guilty, she said she had a mental condition that caused her to hoard money. She said in a court hearing, as reported by WRAL, "I'm very sorry to have caused you and all of us to be here today. Holding an elected position of trust, I committed a serious crime for which I will always be deeply remorseful." She was released earlier this week on August 23rd, which was also her projected release date. She will be on supervision for 1 year. The purpose of post-release supervision, according to a state statute, is to monitor formerly incarcerated people in the community and help them reintegrate into society and continue their treatment or education. Riddick's father wrote an opinion column in the News and Observer in 2019 arguing that Riddick received a particularly harsh sentence, considering that she took responsibility for her actions, encouraged others to cooperate with law enforcement, and paid the money back that she stole. Her father, Peter Marino, had said, "You can find North Carolina embezzlers sentenced to more time than Laura, but none who made full immediate restitution, or have a bad heart condition and circulatory disorder, or were mentally ill." Riddick, a Republican, ran the Wake County Register of Deeds office from 1997 to 2017. Now, the balance of my show today is not going to contain much more hard news, if we can call it that, but it will have a backlog of some cultural and notes, and enough of those to fill up the hour, I believe, which is really all I've been able to obtain from Indie Week and this week's issue. As we know, they are curtailing some of their print issues and doing most of their new releases of information and articles online. So I will head over to Culture Town and and pull something out of the file, and let's get going on that. And I open up Indie Week to a story called Paper Trail by Lena Geller from Durham. And you can call it as cultural as toilet paper can actually be. In August 2018, as dog days of summer waned into a stretch without holidays, a supply store in downtown Durham found something to celebrate, National Toilet Paper Day. The store wrote in a Facebook page, "It's one of those things we sometimes take for granted until we can't find any. Next time you're running low, stop by." Indeed, 2 years later, at the height of the toilet paper panic in 2020, that store, Not Just Paper, was the only place in town with the goods. Not Just Paper's reliable TP supply came from Brame, its Durham-based parent company. During the first few months of that pandemic, Brame, which has 6 distribution sites in North Carolina and Virginia, but only one retail location, Not Just Paper, benefited from a near century's worth of connections. Its founder, R.L. Brame, started building relationships with area paper mills in the 1920s. That company, which is still helmed by the Brame family, turns 100 this year. True to its name, though, Not Just Paper, which sells a myriad of school, office, food service, and cleaning materials, had more than just toilet paper in its inventory of early pandemic essentials. Some items were already on the shelves, namely things like whiteboards, spelling games, and gold star stickers, and others were stocked up per request. Dave Matthews, a Brame branch manager who oversees the store, "You had parents and grandparents all over the place who wanted school desks, so we started selling desks." Per pleas from local restaurant owners, the store also began supplying a wider variety of to-go packaging. It still has a surplus of takeout boxes that say "Best Chicken," which one non-chicken-oriented purveyor requested for dimensional reasons and gladly purchased while options were limited. According to Brame lore, R.L. Brame named the company as such because, first, it was his name, and second, he wasn't sure what other products the company would eventually offer to meet his customers' needs. At the also nebulously named Not Just Paper, the latter point has remained a tenet of the model: community needs drive product changes. These needs, like upping toilet paper counts, are sometimes broad, but many are neighborhood-related or individual, and they aren't typically crisis-induced. During its first decade in business, Not Just Paper, which was founded in 1989, mostly stuck to school supplies, Matthews tells me. We're sitting with his assistant, Carissa Starks, in an office that straddles the store's two sections. The front of the store, which Stark helms, is largely stocked with educational materials. The back, Matthews turf, opens into a 60,000-square-foot warehouse. Matthews joined the staff 15 years ago, around the time the downtown Durham restaurant scene was heating up. Budding food businesses needed a place to buy things like packaging and piping tips in small quantities, so the store began stocking them. Then people started asking for party supplies. There wasn't a party store within a 10-mile radius of downtown. Staff outfitted the front section of the store with balloons, streamers, and birthday banners. Both Matthews and Starks came to Not Just Paper after working positions at Walmart. "They're a lot happier here," they say, and I believe it. They frequently talk over each other, racing to relay the same colorful tidbits. "Have I heard Brame's cameo in the movie Bull Durham, where the company's name can be seen plastered on a prominent ball field billboard? Do I know about the store's sea turtle mascot?" When I ask them if the store has competition, they say Amazon, unanimously. And when I ask for their thoughts on the state of things for small businesses in post-pandemic Durham, Starks mentioned that the owner of a nearby business sometimes stops by so they can, quote, "cry together." Not Just Paper is old school. The day before our conversation, Matthew says, a Not Just Paper sales associate was riding around town with a car full of educational supplies, showcasing products door to door at schools. The store doesn't have its own website, so, in Stark's words, no one really knows what's in here. Still, there's value in hands-on, community-oriented customer service, she notes. Last weekend, for instance, Not Just Paper hosted its Back to School Teacher Bash, an annual event that offers area educators a 20% discount on everything in the store. Also, the internet doesn't stock everything. As a teenager, like R.L. Bram, I started a business and named it after myself. Unlike R.L. Bram, I didn't have the foresight to keep branding vague, and so it remained Lena's Lunchbox after I went on to sell cakes, not lunch food. All of my cakes were packaged in pink pastry boxes I bought at Not Just Paper. The boxes cost around 30 cents each, and let's see, I'll go on just a moment. 30 cents each, and came in every size imaginable. When I moved to Washington, D.C. for college, I couldn't find a single place to buy these cake boxes, either in person, or online. Steady on, John. In quantities under 100, so I returned to Not Just Paper, transporting them back on my lap during mega bus trips. There are things we sometimes take for granted until we can't find them. Toilet paper, cake boxes, stores like Not Just Paper. During my conversation with Matthews and Starks, I learned that Not Just Paper began stocking pink pastry boxes 15 years ago at the behest of a single customer, Leanne Boxleitner, who was in the early stages of her own home baking business at the time. Matthews says I would meet her about halfway between here and Wake Forest, so she wouldn't have to drive so far. People probably thought we were doing a drug deal. I was handing her boxes. She would give me money. She got like $20 of stuff per week. Now Matthews says Boxleitner has a brick-and-mortar bakery on Capitol Boulevard with probably as many employees as we've got. You got to see the whole transformation, I say. You ask me why I'm here, he replies. That's why. Now, I've been sitting on this article for a week, and it concerns the city of Raleigh with its Hopscotch Music Festival, an annual festival. And here's the festival guide for the festival this year. It starts in about a week. I won't go into excessive detail, but I'll list some of the highlights that Jordan Lawrence includes in his music column in Indie Week. If you're going to this year's Hopscotch, he writes, I imagine you don't need me to hype further for the likes of Pavement, Denzel Curry, and Japanese Breakfast on the main stages. So let's get you hyped for the many dynamic acts playing in this year's clubs, offering you the opportunity to bounce through a litany of different sounds long into the night. Here's one act to see at each of these year's 8 indoor spaces, but those are just our picks. Use them as jumping off point to choose your own adventure. And the festival starts a week from today, actually, Thursday. Les the Genius is local rapper, and that will be at 11 p.m. at King's. And he delivers his line in a way that makes you feel like you're living through them. Tap into his energy at King's and let it fuel the rest of your night. At 12 a.m., midnight, Cable Ties. I put off listening to Cable Ties' Merge Records debut, All Her Plans, until this year's schedule dropped. Bad call on my part. It rips. If you're looking for a band that scrambles familiar classic rock with punk elements in a way that's somehow still distinct, this Australian band's searingly anthemic jazz are for you. On Friday, The Poorhouse, P-O-U-R, at 11:30 p.m., presents Rosalie. Across her last two albums, Saxapahaw via Philadelphia musician Rosalie has emerged as one of indie rock's best guitarists and songwriters. She plays song guitar lines, and it doesn't say whether two instruments are. Oh, I guess it's her voice. The Poorhouse at 11:30 p.m., that's a Friday night. Lincoln Theater, Also on Friday, Jeff Parker, ETA. So I love seeing large crowds in Hopscotch's biggest rock club vibe to experimental excellence. Tortoise and Battles are two highlights from previous years. Jeff Parker, a free jazz guitarist, will blend hip-hop with ethereal jazz with his ETA Ivy Tet Ensemble. Let's pack out Lincoln for him at the Lincoln Theater on Friday at midnight. One at 12:30 a.m., Daikaiju, the taut and towering surf-infused post-punk of Daikaiju is impressive, but they earn their monstrous name with do-it-yourself spectacle. Their guitarist and drummer crowd surf while playing. They typically hand out drums for onlookers to smash along. They frequently light the top of their tour van on fire. Who wouldn't want to see that? That's a Friday night. Saturday night, the final day and night of the festival. Of course, these are all nighttime. And Cro-Mags is going to play at Slim's at 12:30 a.m. I have a koozie from a former Hopscotch that reads Slimes, twisted on the club's name. I'm not sure if the message on this green absolute drink holder was added by Slims or a perfect joke, but it aptly reflects the many sweaty, raucous shows that tight shotgun bar has hosted during Hopscotch. Check out what's sure to be an explosive scene when the seminal hardcore thrash band Cro-Mags plays and uphold the tradition. At Nash Hall, you've got setting. Splitting sets to see two things you've just got to see is a hallowed Hopscotch tradition, and I encourage it Saturday night. Skip out of Cro-Mags over at Slim's early and get to Nash, that worship hall for the church on Morgan. During Hopscotch, the beautifully reverberating space has become a place to worship at the altar of experimental sound. Setting, a new trio, lays electro-folk percolations in a way that's both innervating and calming on the debut single, Zoetropics. And the final recommendation for this club dates at Hopscotch, Zach Mexico. This pick offers a Hopscotch standby in a new venue that's at the Transfer Company. I haven't seen a show there yet, but I haven't encountered a room that can quell the tenaciously long-form surf psych garage grooves of Zach Mexico. End your Saturday here and ride the waves with them into the wee hours. What does that mean? That means that show begins at 1 a.m. And actually, that column by Jordan Lawrence was more or less a sidebar to an overall article about Hopscotch this year. And it's specifically is return of small clubs and a renewed chance for local acts to play shoulder to shoulder with music legends. So Jordan Lawrence writes here about that festival, September 7th through 9th. Many local bands dream of sharing a bill with an act like Pavement. Playing tennis with Pavement? Probably not so many. Dear Blanca, an explosively rumbly indie rock band from the capital city of South Carolina, is poised to realize both dreams during Hopscotch Festival in Raleigh, where they will open for their good friends, L.A.-based trio The Sloppy Boys, in a small underground club. Dear Blanca singer Dylan Dickerson says when his group was added to the lineup for the 2023 event, he dove deep into Pavement's catalog, which he didn't know well. Enamored, he dug deeper, discovering that the bands Stephen Malkmus and Bob Nastanovich had an affinity for tennis, a sport he'd gotten hooked on in the past year. Dickerson says, I tweeted at Bob, and he got back to me and seemed interested. Stephen tends to bring his rackets anyway and likes to try to squeeze hitting around in wherever he can. After that tweet, Dickerson had Nastanovich on his podcast and plans solidified. They now have a text thread going on about it. Festival director Nathan Price reports he's oh so aware of the potential for a Pavement Dear Bianca tennis match. I love it, he says, of the opportunities locals get to rub elbows with artists they admire and play for packed rooms. I haven't been able to play Hopscotch in years because I'm always so busy. But when you're playing in that setting where you're in a full crowd, everybody's into it, it just feels like how it should feel. And I love hearing from an out-of-towner about a discovery they don't know. Isn't a huge band, like they'll talk about a Dear Blanca or somebody as their big discovery that weekend. The chances for popular regional acts to play sports with indie rock royalty and locals to play crowded venues get a boost when Hopscotch returns September 7th. For the first time since the pandemic shut down the event in 2020 and heavily altered it for the next 2 years, the festival is bringing back ticketed club venues. In 21, there were no official club shows, just two outdoor main stages in Moore Square and City Plaza. In 22, free, mostly local late-night shows were added at Slim's and the Poorhouse, both mainstay clubs from that festival's first decade, when indoor programming spanned 10 or more clubs and went from the early evening into the wee hours. This year, the festival announced it would have official pass-required shows at 6 clubs, also bringing back 4 other previous hallmarks in the Lincoln Theater, King's, Neptune's, and the Wicked Witch. When the official schedule dropped, it added Nash Hall and the first-time Hopscotch venue, Transfer Company, bringing the final number up to 8. And those club shows are once again filled out with some exciting touring acts, including Saturday Night Live star Sarah Sherman, highlighting Hopscotch's first ever comedy stage. The Sloppy Boys, acclaimed hip-hop artists Prince Paul and Cool Keith, free jazz legend Jeff Parker, thrash punk forerunners Cro-Mags, and more. Price says the late venue additions were partially due to the festival not knowing if it would be able to use them, but also because high ticket sales made it attractive to have 2 more places for Hopscotch to spread out its crowd. An array of club options has always been crucial to Hopscotch, serving as the crux of its choose-your-own-adventure concept. That festival is named after a 1960s stream of consciousness novel that can be read in different sequences. Previous years have given attendees the chance to jump between rock and hip-hop, offbeat pop, heavy metal, various shades of folk and country, and a host of experimental outliers, much of it delivered by world-class artists who rarely tour through the state. But Price says he thinks the renewed excitement around this year's festival is about more than the return of a proper club lineup. Booking the main stages this year with acts that got closer to the heights reached by previous festivals, which hosted towering names like Solange and Public Enemy, James Blake and Run the Jewels, Dwight Yoakam and Spiritualized, was a top priority, an effort to reclaim the prestige Hopscotch held prior to that pandemic. The headliners at this year's festival got close to that level. There's indie rock giants in Dinosaur Jr. and Pavement, who last played here in North Carolina in 1999, and whom Price has described as the festival's biggest get ever. There's an emo luminary in American Football who has never played in the state. There's a rapper, hot as anyone around, in Denzel Curry. There's an exceedingly popular indie popper in Japanese Breakfast and an equally well-liked country songstress in Margot Price. Still, the return of clubs in earnest for the first time this decade is what makes this year's lineup really feel like Hopscotch again. And it's a big deal for Raleigh's club landscape, which is waking back up as people return to it. King's, the eclectic rock club institution that launched in its second location in 2010 at the inaugural Hopscotch, started its slow reemergence from the pandemic at last year's festival with a few day parties. This year's will serve as another point of transition as Paul Seiler and Chidi Kumar are in the midst of working out a deal to hand over the club's reins to a longtime member of the local music scene, with details to be announced in the near future. Seiler says he and Chidi Kumar, guitarists in the long-running Raleigh rock band Birds of Avalon, are excited to see the club go to a team that understands the local music community and knows how to keep Kings going into the future. Siler and Kumar will still be an active part of that community, planning to host shows on the patio at their new restaurant, Aja, located in Raleigh's Five Points neighborhood, just outside of downtown. As for the other two floors in the couple's triple-decker downtown nightlife hub, Neptune's, the cocktails and dance-focused bar in the basement, and Garland, the former restaurant on the ground floor, Siler says they have already handed off that lease for Neptune's and have lined up a good person to take over the Garland space. Siler is intimately acquainted with Hopscotch, having steered Kings and Neptune's through its energetic chaos throughout the 2010s. He's happy to see the festival getting back to itself. Siler explains, when they made the announcement of the lineup, it just felt like it had the best reaction and reception of any Hopscotch since maybe the first or the third one. This business does not guarantee that it's going to be enough money. I mean, most of us who do this have other jobs. So it's nice to know that for 3 days of the year, you're going to be busy. Every year that Hopscotch happens and I walk outside the building, the energy on the street and the type of people that come and the feeling around it, I'm always just, God, I wish this was the way Raleigh was all the time, he adds. And while Hopscotch also highlights some issues he sees with downtown, whether the people who attend or play could afford the apartments going up in the area, for instance, Siler says the event instills hope, allowing him to revel in what downtown can be at its best. Adam Lindstedt, who owns the Poorhouse, echoes many of Siler's sentiments, calling this year's lineup the best he's seen in a while. With his business expanding its purview, working to establish the first mass-production-capable vinyl record plant in Raleigh, he's eager for excitement to return to the local music scene and says it's the most magical time of year for live music in Raleigh. Everybody's out. Everyone's happy. They're doing it all day and night. The club does great revenue during the event, typically bringing in over 4 days what it would during a couple weeks of okay business, with little more of half of that coming from day parties. And while Lindstedt says the club hasn't really seen a drop-off during the past two COVID years, he does see key advantages to being included on the proper club lineup this year. He says, if you buy a club ticket and you're being able to bounce around from place to place, odds are you're probably going to stop by at some point. And the clubs offer opportunities for acts outside of rock, folk, and pop. Abyssal Frost, a relentlessly churning black metal band from Atlanta and Charlotte that's playing an official set at this year's Hopscotch, is timing the release of its first single from its second album to line up with the festival, in hopes the appearance can amp excitement for the new record. Abyssal Frost's Keenan Kerr says it's a massive, massive opportunity for us to be able to not only just be playing live in general and having that whole ecosystem moving toward a place where it's thriving again, but then especially something like Hopscotch. We know we're going to have national acts, so we're going to have that attention. Durham's Juice Lord, an aggressively thoughtful rapper who's returning to the festival for another official set, also emphasizes the opportunity that festivals provide to connect with bigger artists and new audiences, explaining that these advantages are increased when the event happens where you live. He says about playing Hopscotch alongside bigger national names like Cool Keith and Prince Paul, I feel like it evens out the ground more. A lot of times, especially if someone is in your wheelhouse, they'll reach out to you beforehand and be like, where can we do this? Where can we do that? Because you're an act that's booked up there as well, and they know that people know of you. Kim Register is the owner of Durham's Pinhook Rock Club and a stalwart local musician who emphasized bringing a queer lens to the Southern rock ethos, per the website for their band, Meltdown Rodeo. Having played the festival several times in the past and returning this year with that new outfit, Register is excited for the opportunity Hopscotch provides to a diverse range of acts and expresses hope this aspect will expand in the future. Quote, I think every white man-run organization or white person-run organization, including Pinhook, all of us should have meetings or conferences or groups of people that aren't involved in the organization to speak out and to get information from about how it could be more inclusive, because it's hard to see that when you are the majority. Register circles the idea of bringing in outside artists to curate more shows as one way Hopscotch could accomplish this. Having at least one artist-curated stage was a hallmark of that festival in previous years, and like the expanded club lineup, it's also coming back this year. The festival has teamed with local hip-hop collective Raleighwood to program the Thursday night bill at King's. Price, the director, says, we tried to have it as diverse as possible. I think we did a pretty good job, especially on the main stages again. We tried real hard to make sure that it was as diverse as possible, and not just, you know, a bunch of indie bands. Now, I may reference Hopscotch a little more if it comes up in any further articles, but that's the two main bits about Hopscotch in Raleigh this year, September 7th through 9th. Tickets, curated tickets, tickets bought in advance. There are no links, of course, on the radio that I can tell you about, but you research Hopscotch Festival on your web, and you'll find out how to purchase tickets and what they comprise. Remember that there's some of these bar hopping, in effect, club hopping tickets for after midnight to get you around at a lot of venues. But then there are the main stages during the day, and some of that music is, I believe, free because it's outdoors. What can they do? All right, that's Hopscotch, and now we'll move on to a couple other, I think, music and arts-related articles. Kaisha Jennings, now a music columnist for Indie Week, writes, Turning the Tables. This is a lengthy article. As hip-hop turns 50, icons from across the state reflect on how the genre took shape in North Carolina and changed everything. This year marks the 50th anniversary of hip-hop, a genre that revolutionized global music. It originated on the streets of New York City in the late 20th century with an infamous back-to-school jam hosted by DJ Kool Herc and his sister, Cindy Campbell, on August the 11th, 1973. In the decades since, hip-hop has transcended its humble beginnings, revolutionizing global music, not to mention film, television, marketing, fashion, language, education, and so many other elements that permeate our daily lives. A genre that melds rhythmic beats with intricate wordplay and storytelling, hip-hop has challenged societal norms, given voice to the marginalized, and drawn together people from different backgrounds and countries. As we reflect upon five decades of its evolution, it's now more clear than ever that the story of hip-hop is a collection of regional stories with shared elements. Local venues, DJ collectives, and curators. In North Carolina, hip-hop's lineage is directly connected to the rich traditions of Black Southern music. From Negro spirituals to blues, jazz, funk, and gospel, North Carolina is home to a number of important musicians and styles, and its contribution to the development of Black music, including hip-hop, cannot be overstated. Nevertheless, the Tar Heel State often remains overlooked for its significant contributions to the genre. In this oral history, the Indie delves into the dynamics of the artists, DJs, producers, and curators who have woven the fabrics of our state's most influential rap groups, to Josimo, one of Durham's most notorious MCs, the world veteran DJ Cruz, the world-famous Butta Team, and Little Brother, and Cooley High, Raleigh's hometown heroes, and legendary movements like Microphone Mondays and Carolina Waves. These voices illuminate the often untold stories of resilience and creativity in North Carolina. Below, these trailblazers share their earliest memories of hip-hop in North Carolina and what they consider their greatest contributions to the state's hip-hop history to be. First up, DJ Samps, a DJ radio host from Fayetteville and Durham, who says, I began the Street Flavor Mix Show on Duke University's college station in May of 1994, and almost 30 years later, I have supported a number of independent North Carolina hip-hop artists over the years. One of my favorite moments was when Ninth Wonder came straight from the recording studio with a new song titled Speed for me to debut. I played it at least two times, maybe three. After the show, he, Font, and rapper Big Pooh went to the parking lot and had a discussion for several hours. What came from that discussion was what we now know as Little Brother. Next, producer Crisis, Jamla and the Soul Council, a producer from Durham. If you notice, all the OG rappers from the 90s and earlier have moved to North Carolina. We got Big Daddy Kane, Special Ed, Mike G from Jungle Brothers, and Sadat X. One of my most favorite recent hip-hop moments is definitely Gene Brown's beat battle, the Gene Brown Beatdown with Knots and Bink. That night was electric. I did a beat battle back in like 2003 or 4, and I want to say J. Cole was in the crowd that night. And he challenged Jay Wonder in the parking lot. That was some wild stuff to look back on, because he wasn't even J. Cole back then. He was Therapist. I have so many great moments. Being part of the Justice League, we were doing shows at a lot of the local venues like Local 506, the Hideaway, Kratz Cradle, when they had the video store next to it, and the brewery. A lot of those venues are gone now. Shout out to Mike Nice, Courtney C, DJ Bro Rab, and the whole Butta team, because they had the crazy college radio show at NC Central on Saturdays called Straight from the Crate. Shout out to DJ Samps, because he had a radio show at Duke on Fridays. Shout out to DJ Resident. He had the show at NC State. College radio was super heavy in the early 2000s in North Carolina. That was where I was getting a lot of my underground stuff from. I heard True Master by Pete Rock for the first time from Bro Rab. That was a moment for me to stop everything I was doing to try to figure out what that was. And from a DJ from Durham, Bro Rab, from the world-famous Butta team, Sweet Emma's was a record store that my dad used to take me to right off of University Drive. Back in the mid to late 80s, it was a record store that looked like a house. You'd walk in there and there were all these used records. By the time Sweet Emma's closed, the old man record shop was going. We also had the Record Rack in Forest Hills and another commercial record bar in South Square Mall, Camelot. There was a Butta team before I even got involved, but the Butta team that really made a difference was myself, Skaz Digga, Mike Nice, DJ Mad, Courtney C, DJ Lil B. We were a collection of DJs, producers. We had accounts with record labels where we could go out and work the records for certain labels. We were one big self-contained unit of everything. We did the radio. Mike Nice and DJ Mad had a radio show at Duke in 93, and then in 96, Mike started hosting Straight from the Crate at NCU. And I joined him in 97. For a number of years, we hosted a rap battle called Duel of the Iron Mike, named after the GZA song. We did parties and the Welcome to Durham documentary. I've been professionally touring with Kid and Play since 2016. They've taken me all around the world, and Skaz has been Big Daddy Kane's DJ at least since 1999. Next up, Kays, a rapper curator host from Chapel Hill, who says the first time I saw a group from North Carolina in the Source was 95. Bomb Shelter is a group from Fayetteville made up of Nervous Wreck and Filth E. Rich. When I was really on my stuff, I pursed my first album and would drive city to city on some Master P stuff. It was nothing to see me pull up in the Honda, pop the trunk, and have like 1,000 CDs. I did that in every city. Fayetteville when I got there.
I developed a relationship with the nervous wreck, of Bomb Shelter. Then they started coming to Microphone Monday and would bring a 16-year-old light-skinned kid named Therapist. Nerve used to be all like, "Hey, Cass, I got my man with me. He too young to be in here." I was always like, "No, you're good. Just come around. Just, you know, long as he not drinking, we good." Of course, Therapist is now known as J. Cole today and one of the biggest artists to represent North Carolina. Okay, rapper Big Pooh from Virginia and Durham. My earliest memory of hip-hop in North Carolina is 98, when I came down to school for college, hearing all the different regions and styles, and it was all infused into one. I'm from Virginia, the DMV area, so it was either go-go or New York rap for the most part. So coming down to North Carolina and really getting a melting pot of hip-hop was refreshing. 2000 to 2001 was a moment in time for North Carolina. The underground hip-hop scene was thriving, as there were a number of venues to perform at. There was the Hideaway in Chapel Hill, Local 506, Cat's Cradle. The scene, which was still kind of new, was filled with a bunch of hungry, talented people that wanted to show that North Carolina not only had something to say, but that North Carolina wasn't what people thought or perceived Southern hip-hop to be. Everybody supported each other, and it was a great, great time. From Cooley High, Tab One, a rapper from Raleigh and Burlington, says, "In the late 90s, I saw Sankofa and Typhoo at Cat's Cradle. They were the first NC-based hip-hop groups I saw live. North Carolina hip-hop is undefinable. There's too many different styles and variations to put a pin on it. North Carolina pulls influence from all over. I have a ton of favorite hip-hop-related memories. If I had to pick one, I'd say it was opening for Little Brother at Hopscotch in 2019. What a great moment in time." Nancy O., hip-hop enthusiast and blogger in High Point. "My favorite memory related to hip-hop in North Carolina is when Little Brother reunited at the Art of Cool Festival in 2018. For many years, we heard from Fonte, Ninth Wonder, and Pooh that the group was never getting together again. I've been a huge Little Brother fan since 2001, and the first time I ever saw them perform was that year at the Cabaret, a club that was in the basement of UNC Chapel Hill's old student union. From that point on, I was a fan. It was so exciting to see them together again at the 2018 Art of Cool Festival. The performance was so energetic, and the moment brought back so many great memories. I was so excited, I literally broke out in goosebumps. My greatest contribution to North Carolina hip-hop, first and foremost, is being a fan of the culture. Second is the work I did with Nancy O's hip-hop site remains active as an archive, it says, and my YouTube channel from 2008 to 2018 to document North Carolina hip-hop. It brought me a lot of joy to the point where it didn't feel like work. I have a lot of great memories and positive experiences. I loved going to live shows, other events, interviewing artists, meeting people, talking about the culture, often online, and so much more. Around 2017, a student archivist from UNC Chapel Hill Wilson's Library Southern Historical Collection reached out. He conducted an extensive interview about my blog, radio show, etc., to archive in the library as part of North Carolina's hip-hop history. Up to that point, I didn't even realize the work I was doing would create space for a historic opportunity like that. At the end of it all, I was just having fun, trying to be positive, encouraging, sharing what I learned about North Carolina hip-hop through the blog and radio show. I keep the site active as an archive, as a testament to the extensive and momentous impact that North Carolina artists, personalities, music producers, other content creators, etc. I have contributed to hip-hop culture around the world. Hip-hop may not have been born in North Carolina, but it most certainly lives here, in the past, present, and future." A short contribution from Finn, the DJ, formerly known as Chondon of the Justice League, New York City. My favorite memory related to hip-hop in North Carolina was having legendary artists like Boot Camp Click, Gene Gray, and Murs, just to name a few, fly down here to work with everyone in my crew, the Justice League. Those recording sessions will live in my mind forever. Now we have rapper, singer, songwriter, and producer Fonte. Shout out to the Butter Team. They used to host these rap battles called Duel of the Iron Mike at the Durham Armory. The first year I lost in a round to a guy from Durham named Omotad. He went on to battle Joshua Gunn, who was a teenager, damn near a child prodigy, won the entire competition. I never lost a battle after that. North Carolina has always been a bridge for hip-hop. We're literally in the middle. We are the South. We're not deep South. Like, we're not Louisiana. We're not Florida. Growing up here, there was always a melting pot of different sounds heard because the number of transplants surrounding colleges and universities and up north drug dealers moving up and down I-95. We've always offered a little bit of everything, and of course there is a heavy East Coast influence, but also there is a definite Southern influence because the style of life here is very much Southern and very laid back. It's really not surprising when I see so many OG rappers like Big Daddy Kane and Sadat X from Brand Nubian have moved here. Me and all my brothers that I came up with doing this with, I think with the example of how to make it from North Carolina without having to leave. I've been blessed enough to see the world, but none of those places ever compared to home. I've always considered North Carolina to be an additional group member of Little Brother. We have Joshua Gunn, a Durham rapper, who says, I remember being in like 5th and 6th grade, and I would call into the radio late night to rhyme on the air. This is back when being on the radio was a big deal, and any time you were on the radio, you felt like you made it. Then we started finding out about college radio. WXDU at Duke, led by DJ Stamps and Big Doe, and WNCU had a show with DJ Bro Rab and Mike Nice called Straight from the Crate. Those were spots where you could actually go up to the radio and rhyme. It made us feel like legit superstars because everybody listened to that radio back then. I used to call in and spit my rhymes, and the DJs would go crazy. That's really how I started to take my craft seriously, and that's how I got exposed to all the other dope MCs in North Carolina. Hip-hop radio was so vital to the culture back then. It probably sounds crazy today to say in today's context, where most people don't really tap in with radio unless it's to hear a mainstream artist, but the radio really helped us build our scene, especially in the Triangle. My favorite hip-hop memory is actually an entire era. I was in high school in the early 2000s, and we had a crazy movement of talent happening in the Triangle. Although we were all competing with each other, there was also a spirit of cooperation. We had movements like Typhoo, K's, Justice League, Cahill, MOS, Josimo, so many dope MCs, producers, and groups, all really cultivating their own sound with legitimate followings. This was back when the national hip-hop scene wasn't paying North Carolina any attention, so we had to build our own scene. I was also heavy into the battle scene and had some dope battles against folks like Fonte, Josimo Kays, and so many others. We really were living the culture back then, and being the best MC was the only thing that mattered. That was the greatest period in the history of North Carolina hip-hop. You just had to be there. From Fuquay, Verina and Durham, Josimo, rapper. My earliest memory of hip-hop in North Carolina is Microphone Mondays at Local 506, run by Kays and Dion. This was the first spot where local talent or underground talent would come and get a chance to get their bars off. Microphone Mondays was the biggest local show around. People would come all the way from Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro, and Fayetteville just to come to Chapel Hill to rock. I don't feel like North Carolina hip-hop has a style or identity. There is no North Carolina sound. We're East Coast and we're Southern. You get the best of both worlds here. When I think about my greatest contribution to North Carolina hip-hop, I was like that organic guy before social media. You know, before everybody had smartphones. I was showing up to venues with 75 people. I was even selling out venues before I really got noticed. I had a real organic following that grew from word of mouth. Now, radio personality Brian Dawson, a DJ from Durham. I actually met Curtis Blow when he was performing at the Durham Armory. My dad had a hair salon that was around the corner, and there were all these flyers about Curtis Blow coming to town. I walked around the corner, and at the time, unbeknownst to me, I caught Curtis Blow walking in for what was to be a sound check. I had no idea what a sound check was back then. I ended up talking to him, and he gave me two tickets. Years later, I had a chance to catch up with him in a recording studio. He was doing a record with DJ Nabs, and I had an opportunity to talk to him and thank him. His kindness at that time meant a lot to me. He was one of the biggest artists around, and the Breaks was a historic record. I've never forgotten that moment. Next, Big Doe, manager and DJ, Connecticut and Durham. I've been the DJ, manager, driver, booking agent, you name it. I helped start the Justice League and the Hall of Justice Production Company. The League was just making music. Once you make music, you have to do something with it. So my thing was to get out and try to do more. In addition to managing the League as a collective, I have also managed individual members. The same for Little Brother. I've managed the group as a collective and have also managed individual members. Managing Ninth took me to some places that LB didn't get to. You know, getting the call about the Mary J. Blige album, getting the paperwork done for Jay-Z, going to meet with Mariah Carey. Right now I'm working with Loot, who is signed to Dreamville. I know we, the Justice League or Little Brother, didn't get a chance to go platinum. But we definitely paved the way and showed other artists that their success did not rely on radio or any support from home. Cash from Jamla and the Soul Council, president of Jamla Records from Rocky Mount. My best friends that I grew up with, Brandon and Brian, introduced me to the Justice League. My brother was already listening to them, but he was in college, so I wasn't getting it direct from him. I was getting it from, you know, the guys I was going to high school with. Once I said something to my brother about them, he was like, oh yeah, I know Font, and me and Ninth used to hoop together at State. And I'm like, oh shoot, you know those dudes. My brother, knowing them, made it seem even better, because the music was just so phenomenal, it was kind of hard to imagine. They were just, you know, regular Joes. I have a number of favorite North Carolina hip-hop moments, but Rhapsody, performing at Deepak during the Art of Cool Festival, was such a dope moment. It was her and Common on that show. At that time, she was working on a Netflix documentary, and the camera crew was there. It was just a really dope moment. When Little Brother had their reunion at Art of Cool a few years back, that was also a dope moment. Now, Miriam Tolbert, a curator and a radio host from Maryland and Raleigh, says, in 2015, I was working at K97.5, where he got a new program director, and he wanted us to be more involved in the local scene, and the first event that was coming up was the Durham Hip Hop Summit. I volunteered to host it, despite never hosting an event before. That was the first time I had ever been to a local hip-hop event. I met Wells, G. Yamazawa, De Niro Farrar. It was also the first time I saw Will Wildfire perform. There were just so many dope artists, and I was inspired. My program director wanted to bring back a local show called 919 Radio, and I volunteered to host it. When it relaunched in 2016, the show became really popular. I had also started doing small shows for local artists, so I decided to rebrand it under one title, so it could be an overall platform and entity that does multiple things. Carolina Waves is now the biggest and most consistent touring platform in North Carolina. Charlie Smarts from Cooley High, a rapper from Greensboro. One of my earliest moments of hip-hop in North Carolina was my mom, Sandra Thompson, opening a show. KRS-One was one of the headliners, and I got to shake his hand. North Carolina has a huge musical history, and it's a hotbed of hip-hop talent. Little Brother, Fonte and Pooh, Jamla with Ninth Wonder, Rhapsody, Reuben Vincent, Dreamwill with J. Cole and Loot. Can't forget about DaBaby and Miz. just so many talented people here. When I think about my greatest contribution, Cooley High has supported the local scene in Raleigh more than just about anyone. Since we started H2O, a student-run organization in college, we've never stopped representing our town to the fullest. That's almost 20 years of classic albums, sold-out shows, and dope parties. And Ill Digits from Cooley High, a DJ from Cary, our last entry. My earliest memory of hip-hop in North Carolina is when I went to see the Executioners perform at the Cat's Cradle in 2002. This group I'd never heard before, opening up for them, and they killed it. At the end of their set, Font said, "Yo, our debut album, The Listening, is dropping soon." The rest is history. And so is this issue of Indie Week, which I had to split in two sections due to an audio glitch of some sort. And we're just going to let the theme music run out when it will. And we thank you all for listening. And John Federson will be back, I hope, next week with Indie Week.